week two of our series, To Be an Ethical Customer, How to Be an Ethical Customer, there are more sheets by the hot water. I hope people received the email that I sent out. If you did not receive the email, if you didn't sign up last week, I actually have some sheets that can be used as sign-up sheets. I'm going to, I think, start them over here and then pass them around, and I'll ask everyone to sort of just pass them around as you can. If you already registered, you do not need to sign in. It's just for people who are not already registered. If you didn't get the email from me with the source sheet, that's a sign either that my email was blocked by your spam blocker or that you haven't signed up. So please make sure that you are listed so that I can send you the source sheets in advance. Those who have been here before know that I also record audio and upload the audio so you can actually get that online, and I'll be sending out the link so that you can download it. I will also ask if people could please silence their cell phones, silence, vibrate, whatever works for you, that would be good. So we had to finish the topic from last week, and I had asked people in the email if they could please bring back their sheets from last week so that we could finish that before we start the new topic. Our topic last week was bargaining. And we talked about garage sales. I saw a great article, actually, just the other day, and I wanted to include it in the email. I forgot to, but if I remember, I'll send it out later today. Someone in England, ended up buying a tin, what's it called, a tintype, they call it? A tintype photograph, one of only two known photographs of Billy the Kid. Billy the Kid and his gang playing croquet, I think, or cricket or croquet or whatever it's called. I'm American. I don't know these things. But apparently it's worth in the millions. In the millions. And he bought it at a garage sale. So that just goes to show you. Go to garage sales. Yes?
He actually found it in a junkyard.
Oh, it was a junkyard?
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought the article was
not. Okay. Well, now my antenna are up for these stories. These are remarkable stories. So we started our discussion last week with this issue of bargaining and the different stages of bargaining for a purchase and the question of the ethics that are involved. And we started by talking about flattery. We gave the case from Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine about a university negotiating with its professors, and the professors are represented by a professor of economics, and the university negotiator does not want to end things on a bad note after he has rejected the proposal from the professors, and so he mentions the somewhat esoteric doctrine invented by this professor of economics and does it as a way of flattering him. And our question was, is that ethical to do that as part of your dialogue, to say things that are clearly empty flattery? And so we said it depends on whether it's an obvious thing or not. If it's obvious that this is part of a convention, this is just a way to signal the person that you want to have a friendly conversation and everybody knows that, then it's okay. But if you're doing it to butter them up because you want to get a better deal, then it's considered inappropriate because it's deceptive. You're pretending that you actually study this person's work and take it seriously and respect it. And in fact, it's not so. That was our first stage. Our second stage was the issue of concealing information. And we talked about the Rothschild myth, right? The story about Rothschild at Waterloo. And again, for those who just came in, maintenance is supposed to be bringing chairs. I hope that will happen soon. The issue of concealing information, the question of, had Rothschild done what it is alleged that he did, which is to say that he had information about the British victory at Waterloo, and before everybody else found out about it, he either bought up British assets, or the alternative version, he sold off his British holdings, and everybody saw him do that, and they sold as well, and then he bought at the bottom. Either version, they're both not true. Would that have been all right? And what we said was, there is a concept of privileged information in which, not privileged information, but information that I acquire by dint of my hard work, by dint of the money that I spend. And the rule is that I'm entitled to keep that information to myself, and I'm entitled to use it to my own advantage. What I'm not allowed to do is to take steps that will deceive other people. That's where we draw the line. What I'm not allowed to do is to do things that will cause other people to think something other than what is true. Had he, in other words, told people, someone asked him, so who won? And he said, the French are winning. That would have been a problem. That would have been active deception. So in the case of the garage sale, if you walk into the garage sale and you tell the people you tell them, I'm an expert in Salvador Dali, and even though this says Dali on the corner, it's actually a fake. And you know that it's not true. That's deceptive. That's not allowed. That's a little bit of a brief summary, but it gives us some sense of what we talked about last week. And it brings us to the third topic. Just by a show of hands, how many people actually do have the sheet from last week? Okay, so good. So a lot of people have it. Okay, thank you. So if you take a look on the sheet at source number, this is the sheet from last week. If you take a look at source number 10, this is the issue of bluffing. Bluffing within a negotiation, where you say, there is no way I will accept anything less than whatever, or there is no way I will pay anything more than whatever, and it's not true. You know fully well it's not true. You say, my limit is $10. You know full well you'll pay $15. You're at the garage sale and the guy has a Salvador Dali and he's offering it for $10 and you say, I'll only pay $5. You know full well that if he says $10, you're going to say, thank you very much, and you're going to give him $10. So is this inappropriate, this act of bluffing? So take a look at number 10. There are a lot of articles online about negotiating. I pulled one. In The Negotiator, actor Samuel Jackson plays a police hostage negotiator who takes his own hostages to prove his fellow officers framed him for murder. During an incredibly tense scene, Jackson drags one of his hostages from view while screaming into the phone. If you've ever seen a Samuel Jackson movie, you know what he looks like when he's screaming. He plays this one role with great flexibility. We then hear a gunshot followed by dead silence. Everyone, especially the police barricaded outside, believes Jackson has murdered the hostage. This is critical. Why? Because Jackson, in what we later found out was a bluff, just established his credibility. If the police didn't believe Jackson would harm a hostage, then little would prevent them from storming the place. In other words, what's the value of bluffing?
Sometimes the person, your opposite,
well, to get them to believe whatever the bluff is, yes, but more than that, phrase it stronger.
It's like ammunition.
Well, it's ammunition. It's a threat to get people to do what you want them to do, but what you really are doing, and it's funny the way that this writer worded it, and that's why I used this particular one, you establish your credibility by lying. Right? You establish your credibility by lying. You say, I would kill them, and here, I just killed someone, which you didn't do, in order to get them to believe that you would, in fact, kill somebody. And the problem with it on the face of it is something we already talked about last week in source number 6. We said that God despises a person who speaks one way with his mouth and another with his heart. What is this, if not speaking one way with your mouth and another with your heart? When you stand at the garage sale and you say, I am only going to pay $5, and you know full well that's not true, that is deceptive. So does that mean you're not allowed to do it? No. Why not?
Everybody knows it's a part of the game.
Everybody knows it is part of the game. It's not dishonest if what you are doing is employing a standard method of signaling, just like we talked about when we dealt with flattery. The same thing is true if everybody knows that this is the way the game is played, right? If in the old days, you know, if you go back a couple of decades, it was a little bit safer than it is now. But if you would go to the Arab Shuk, right, in the old city in Jerusalem, if you didn't bargain, there was something wrong with you. No one actually expected that you were going to pay the price that was named when you picked the item up. Right? That wasn't the point. It would almost be disappointing to the fellow on the other side. Like, wait, what happened? If you take a look at source number 11, we find this idea back in the Talmud. Bargaining in the Middle East is very, very old. The Mishnah there, this text from the Talmud, and when we talk about a Mishnah, you're talking about a text that's a couple of thousand years old, is talking about vows that a person makes which are not really binding. And one of them is called Nidrei Zeruzin, vows of goading, a vow that somebody takes in order to get, in order to move someone, in order to get someone to do something. And the Mishnah says in Source 11, what are vows of goading? What does that mean, a vow of goading? He was selling an item, and he said, may this be consecrated, may it be dedicated to the temple, and if something is dedicated to the temple, I'm not allowed to use it. So he's saying that this item should be dedicated to the temple. If I would sell for less than a sella, I would never go lower than a sella. If I would go lower than a sella, it's off limits. It's dedicated to the temple. It's now temple property. I would never do it. And the other fellow, the buyer, said, may this be consecrated if I would offer more than a shekel. A shekel being half of a sella. Right? So he says, well, I would never go higher than, and if I would, this would be property of the temple. And these are vows. These are normally binding. Both of them intend to meet at 3 dinar, which is the midpoint. A sella being 4 dinar. So they both intend to meet halfway, and therefore we understand these aren't serious vows. And they're not actually binding. And if you take a look at source number 12, you find Tosfot, that anthology of commentaries recorded and as I wrote there, 12th, 13th century Western Europe, from the start when they vowed, they wanted 3. They both were thinking about 3 dinar. We can testify that they intended this. Everybody knows it. Therefore, it is no vow. So this is the protocol that everybody bluffs when engaged in this sort of process. Then no, that's not considered to be dishonest. Clear? Straightforward, I think?
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. What it means when we say it's part of the game is that you're not saying what your words say. You're conveying something that is beyond the words. In the same way that asking your rival on the other side, how are the kids doing, is not because you want to know how the kids are. What you are conveying is, this is a friendly conversation. As opposed to if you walk into the room and you put your brief down on the table and you say, all right, what's your best offer? Where it's clearly not a friendly conversation. By asking how are your kids, what you're really doing is saying, I want to have a friendly conversation. And that's what's going on here. What you're saying is, you know, I don't want to pay what you are saying. You're not really saying, and a sella is my price. Ian. Oh, so Ian asks, why is gambling frowned upon in Judaism? So you're assuming it is. You know how many synagogues have bingo games and casino nights and whatnot? I know of a synagogue out west that actually they funded a new roof by staffing the local casino for a night. So it's a good question. But no, there are actually two separate problems that are involved classically in gambling. One problem is what's called asmachta. Asmachta is a term from the word lismoch. Any Hebrew speakers, to be someich on something means what? To rely on it, to depend on it, exactly. When people play games, even games that are pure chance, they often believe that they have special skills. You know, I'm going to be really good at blackjack and I'm going to win because I'm good at it. When realistically you're at the mercy of much of what's dealt to you, I think. Not that I know what blackjack is, but when people play these games, they think they have skill. And therefore, if you're playing a game in which the participants are holding their money, and they put their money in thinking that they're going to win, then when somebody takes it away from them, it's quasi-theft. Because they didn't enter expecting to lose. They didn't really believe they were going to lose that money. That's one argument. The other argument that's brought, which may apply far beyond gambling, is, as the Talmud calls it, a no osek biyishuvo shel olam. A person who makes his money off of gambling is not involved in productive settling of the world. Meaning, you're making your money by tricking other people out of theirs. It's not something that adds anything to the world. You didn't create a product. You didn't offer a service. All you did was bet with somebody about a card that's going to come up, and you got their money. So therefore, that's frowned upon, number one, because it's not contributing to the world. And number two, the major application of somebody being a gambler is disqualification to testify in court. Because we're concerned that when they are testifying in a case involving some monetary claim, they don't value money the way that other people do. The gambler knows, easy come, easy go. Today I made $10,000, tomorrow I might lose $15,000. And that's just the way it is. As opposed to the plumber who's involved in the case, who worked really hard, you know, to get that money, they don't value it the same way, they don't take it as seriously as others do. Those are the two arguments, Talmudically, for why it would be frowned upon. Again, there's more to be said, and so on, but that's the basics of the issue. So, the fourth and last issue carried over from last week is the issue of diversionary tactics. And I go back to the point about this economics argument, the esoteric law of economics, which was mentioned in source number four. When Pelt and Wyman being the professor and Pelt being the university negotiator, sit down at the table and they're having their conversation, and Pelt makes this sort of offhand comment about Wyman's esoteric law of household consumption. So we already explained that that's a little bit of flattery. But it also plays another role. The way the Rabbi Dr. Levine presented the case was the following. The university is pleading poverty, right? Because that's what they're going to do when the professors say, we want more. The university says, well, we can't afford it. The professor says, well, you know, universities have these great endowments. And people are donating money to them. Why can't some of that somehow find its way to support these raises for the professors? And at that point, the university negotiator, Pelt, comes back with his comment about this law of household consumption, which doesn't really answer the question at all. But what's he doing, aside from flattering by quoting Wyman's rule, he's creating a diversion. He's getting him off into something else to distract him so that he won't pursue the fact that last week the newspaper said the university received a brand new gift of $350 million. It's a diversion. And people do this all the time in negotiations. They'll mention something that's not really relevant as a means of distracting the other party. They didn't say anything untrue. Is there anything wrong with creating a diversion? What would you say?
Depends what the goal is.
Depends what the goal of the diversion is. The goal of diversion is to distract the other side so that he will not make claims that actually could help his argument. Sorry?
Diversion is common.
Diversion is common.
We just went through it.
I'm not going there.
But if you're a good negotiator, you will use that. It's a red herring to distract.
Unless you meant the Blue Jays diversion. Winning a game to make you not notice that they're going to lose the other four. Sorry?
Don't say that. No,
sorry.
Yes. A tactic of that.
Well, it can be. Right? Can diversion be a tactic of theft? Right? And it certainly can be. I mean, you think of the classic as the pickpocket. Right? Absolutely, it can be a tactic of theft. If they, you know, look over here, and then I do whatever over here, it absolutely can be.
That's not in relation to negotiations. It's a whole different...
Right. That won't necessarily apply to the negotiation case that we gave. However, there are cases that are closer. Let me give you an example. I'm selling somebody a car. And I say to this person, you know, the car that I'm going to sell you is a used car. It's a 2004. I've had it for a while. There is this one thing. Every once in a while, the airbag light goes on because there's an issue with the sensor that's inside the seatbelt, and that's an issue that I have to admit is there. And it is genuinely there. But I mention that so that that will catch his attention, and he won't look for other things. It's just a diversion. I didn't say anything untrue. Yes?
In politics, they do it all the time.
Like I said, trying really hard. I think we need... Sorry?
Doesn't make it right.
Doesn't make it right, but what have I done wrong? Caveat emptor, if he wants to avoid buying a blemished item, let him look for it. I didn't stop him.
If he hasn't told you the one thing is wrong, so he knows that at least that thing is wrong.
Yeah. I didn't say to him only this thing is wrong.
That's right.
Yes, there was a hand here. Right, sometimes the diversion is actually helpful for moving things forward. It can actually be a positive. And everybody involved will agree that it's a positive. We needed that so that we would stop, staring daggers at each other. At times it could actually be very good. By the way, just where is the sign-in sheet? Just to make sure that it is going around. Because I lost track of where it was. It's over there. Okay, so if anyone isn't signed in, if you didn't get the email with the source sheet, please make sure that you get that. Marlene has it in the back corner. Thank you. So take a look at source number 13. A case from the Talmud involving sale of a cow. Easily applicable to the car or any other purchase one might want to describe. If one sells a cow and says, this cow gores, bites, kicks, and sprawls. Okay? It attacks people, it bites, it's violent, it's going to squat down on the ground and you're not going to be able to do anything. But it only has one of those defects, which he included among these defects. Right? So it doesn't actually do all four of these things. It only does one of them. That is grounds for claiming it was an erroneous purchase. Why? Why is it false pretenses? I told him it does four things wrong and it only does one of them.
Because he may expect he may want them to do the other.
No, he doesn't. He's not looking for... This isn't like cow fighting where he wants a dangerous cow.
Well, it could be negative because he really wants to get rid of this cow. It could be diseased or something. So he's using all these negative things.
Now, there's no defect other than one of the items on this list. It's a trick. And you all would get taken. Because you know what happens? Let's say this cow only does one thing. Let's say this cow only bites. The purchaser looks at it and says, well, he says it sprawls down on the ground, it gores, it bites. I'm going to see whether it gores. I'm going to see whether it, in fact, sprawls on the ground. I'll take it for a walk. And he inspects it, or he asks people who know, and he says, does this thing sprawl? Does this thing gore? And they say, no. And at that point he says, you know what? This is just an overly cautious seller. This is a manufacturer who says may contain traces of soy, milk, nuts, and they list like 10 different things which were never anywhere near the item because they're worried about litigation. And that's what this seller is doing. And so he thinks, none of them are really on the list. It's fine. He's just being overly cautious, right? Or they sell you a medicine and they list like 20 different side effects. You'd think someone like would be on their deathbed if they took it. That's the fear, is that this is essentially deceptive. You are misleading the purchaser, and therefore if the purchaser buys it, finds one of the defects on it later, can come back and say, this is what we called last week, mekach ta'ut, or mekach ta'us, this was an erroneous purchase. I was deceived into thinking that these flaws aren't here. However, if he names this defect and one other, it is not an erroneous purchase. Meaning that if one of the defects is really there, and you only mention two instead of four, at that point he can't come back to you and say that he checked for one and he didn't check for the other. Because then it was his fault. Because he worked with insufficient evidence. The fact that he looked for one and didn't find it doesn't excuse him from looking for the other. When it's one out of four, he can say, I looked and didn't find two or three.
If it was just two, he should have looked for both. So what the Talmud is trying to do is walk a fine line, and it's not a simple and straightforward line. It's trying to walk a line between diversion, which does not put the other side at a disadvantage, and deception, where you actually put one over on the other guy. And that's a fine line, but that's what we're trying to establish here. Diversion is allowed. Caveat emptor, it's up to the buyer to figure it out. However, when you get to deception, that's a different story. Clear? So for example, actually let's take the following case where on the buyer side. I'm the buyer at the garage sale. And I see the painting. And I look at it and say, that looks interesting. The seller knows me. And the seller knows that I have some expertise. And the seller says to me, does that look like anything special to you? And my response is, first of all, inside, I say to myself, well, he has no right to my information. I worked hard to get that expertise. He doesn't have the right to expect me to tell him what this item is worth. But if I say to him, well, it doesn't look like a Picasso, because I'm thinking inside, it looks like a Klee, right? Is that deception or is that diversion?
Well, that's deception.
Deception. I think also it looks like, to me, it's deception because he takes my statement of, well, it's not a Picasso, to mean, no, it's not something special. Even though what I mean inside is, it's not a Picasso, it's this one. So I think that you have to be very careful about the line between distracting the other person and deceiving the other person. It's not simple. I don't think it's as simple as you see in the one case I brought. It takes more analysis. But that's the last of our discussion from last week regarding bargaining, and it brings us to